You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Lionel Burney and this is the Cycling Podcast. In this week's episode, we're going to hear from Conor Dunn, the Irishman who recently finished his first Grand Tour at the Vuelta a España. He rides for the Aqua Blue team, who became the first Irish squad to get a wild card for one of the three Grand Tours. Now, Conor finished 158th and last overall in the Vuelta, but of course, in order to be last man, you have to complete the course, and that was no mean feat for him, because standing at 6'8" tall, he really couldn't have chosen a worse parkour. There were mountainous stages galore, and in fact, very few what you would call easy days, and so he found almost every day a challenge, and there were certainly some highs and lows for him. And the team, of course, who capped their race with a stage win for Stefan Denifil at the Los Machucos climb. Anyway, between the end of Conor's season at the World Championships in Norway and before he headed off on holiday to Nicaragua, among other places, I caught up with him at his parents' home in Hertfordshire. Good afternoon, Conor. Where are we?
Good afternoon. We're in Flaundon, Hertfordshire, back at my place of birth. Parents' house.
Making an end of season visit home?
Yeah, just back for a couple of days, seeing family and getting ready to go on holidays with my girlfriend.
Where are you off to?
We're actually going to Nicaragua and Guatemala. So,
wow. Yeah. Not your regular sort of holiday destinations. Well, how's that come about?
Me and my girlfriend Stacey, we've always really like to kind of travel a bit in the off season. It's like our best opportunity to do it, and I think it's great just to switch off and really unwind, forget the bike for a month, and yeah, see a new culture, a new country, and yeah, it's something I'm really passionate about actually.
Because a couple of years ago I met you in a cafe in Tring and you were telling me about quite an adventurous trip you'd been on then.
Yeah, so last year we were in Indonesia actually, and then the year before that we were in Costa Rica, and we normally go for kind of 3 or 4 weeks, spend the first week and a bit on the beach just relaxing, and then normally get pretty active, start doing some hikes and crazy jungle hikes and go climb some volcanoes. So it's not a holiday, your typical holiday.
Sounds amazing. What's on the agenda in Nicaragua and Guatemala then?
So we're going to Nicaragua for 2 weeks and we'll probably just travel down the Pacific coast there. And I'm actually quite a keen surfer. It's a bit of a hobby. So I'll be surfing on the safer beaches there. Then we're going to Guatemala for 10 days and we'll probably try and climb a volcano there. There's a few high ones, got up to about 4,000 metres altitude. So, wow. Yeah, we'll spend most of that hiking, and I kind of count that as my first week back of training. I just don't tell my girlfriend that.
So you get a few days at altitude.
Yeah.
Won't do any harm at all.
Exactly.
But you won't have a bike or anything over there?
No bikes, just maybe rent a mountain bike or a little old clanger and go around the lanes and things.
How off the beaten track do you tend to go? I mean, does it get a bit wild at times?
Yeah, we try and go off the beaten track at least once, you know. We'll stick to the slightly touristy areas, and then once we feel a bit, got our bearings and a bit safer, then we'll venture out a bit. But yeah, we've stayed in some awesome places. In Costa Rica, my favourite, we were on a vegan farm with no road access, no electricity, right in the middle of the jungle, like really, really isolated, and it was so good, just switch off, no internet, nothing. It was great.
I mean, is that something you sort of feel like you need? You need to kind of unplug from sort of a more hectic lifestyle every now and again?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really, really valuable. Quite often I actually get to the end of the season and you're so used to going, and it's hard to stop. I think when I force myself away and do something like this, I really do. Like you switch off and you take a couple of weeks and then you relax. And I just think that's so, so good for your body and your mind. By the end of it, my motivation is just so high to get back to start training. And it feels like you're just completely refreshed, you know, in every way. For the rest of the winter, you're going really strong.
So So your girlfriend Stacey, she works in cycling, doesn't she? I mean, is it not the case that you go away, but you're still having conversations about cycling, or do you manage to completely unplug?
Oh, like we'll always talk about it a bit, and I'm so grateful actually that Stacey understands what I do and go through, because to be honest, I wouldn't be able to do it without her. Actually, she's just so good to me. Like, I'll go training and Nice, and I'll come back and she'll have a salad made for me, and I'll get a massage because she's a sports therapist. And you know, on the hard days, she'll like let me off the household domestic duties a bit, and you know, make sure I'm in bed on time. Stacey's just unbelievable to me.
Kind of laughing there and sort of joking, but that's actually really important. I mean, if you need to be with somebody who understands exactly what's required,
yeah, definitely.
Doing hard training blocks, or you know, when you go away racing for a long period of time, I guess.
Yeah, like, it's just unbelievable to me, because I think if you're in a relationship with someone, you really need to be able to support each other, you know, and I try my best to support Stacey and whatever she wants to do too. So yeah, I think that's a positive thing to do in any relationship, you know. I'm really grateful.
Well, when I arrived, I had a quick word with your dad. Your dad's John Dunn?
Yeah.
He was filling me in on kind of his interest in cycling, and the fact that his brother, Roger Dunn, you know, raced in Europe when he was younger, and kind of all fits together. You know, that's kind of the way, you know, people of that generation got into cycling, really. It was kind of a different sport. It wasn't as mainstream, certainly, as it is now. I'm just looking behind... Here, Connor, on the wall of your kitchen here, there's a... It looks... I hope that wasn't a recent drawing. It looks very good, but can you tell me when you drew that? That's a... It looks like a picture of a cyclist.
I think it's actually me and when I was 14 trying to do an imitation of a Lowry.
Ah, okay, yeah, okay. It's not... Yeah, I can see the inspiration. I think probably the smoking chimneys are giving it the Lowry.
Yeah, impression. I'm not quite sure why that's got pride of place in the living room.
I think it's nice. It's nice. But there is a cyclist in that picture.
Though. Yeah.
But cycling was something you got into when you were a kid.
Yeah.
And I was making the joke during the Vuelta podcast that... because I'm from not far from here, I was calling you Hertfordshire's second best Irish cyclist. It was obviously very tongue-in-cheek, but it kind of just struck me that I remembered when I was doing like Criterium racing at Hillingdon you were in some of those races, I think.
Yeah.
If not riding for the Hemel Hempstead clubs, riding for the Glendine probably. And so, you know, my sort of Vuelta claim to fame was that I'd raced with somebody in the peloton. It made me feel a lot younger than I am, and a lot better at cycling than I am. But you kind of came up through the sort of the club scene. Just explain to me how you came to choose riding as an Irishman rather than riding as a Brit.
Well, to be honest, I started cycling in this area with Hemel Hempstead CC firstly. That was when I was maybe 14 or 15. And I used to kind of cycle down to the train station, which was like a 15-minute ride away on Saturday and Sunday. That was really kind of my first glimpse of riding in a group, you know, and I just loved riding with other people and like, attacking them for the signs. First time I went out with the fast riders on a Saturday morning, we met a bit earlier. I got shouted at loads because I attacked them and won the side, and I hadn't done any turns all day, you see, in the bunch, so everyone was shouting at me. We had one of the experienced riders who we called Uncle Baz. He wasn't happy at all, but it was those rides, and there was such a good bunch of guys, and quite a few of them had raced abroad and had good experience of racing, and they really taught me a lot. And I used to kind of go to school and always be looking forward to the weekend to go out with them and have a laugh, you know. That was everything to me. That was the first few times I started pushing myself on a bike too. There was one ride where I went out and I didn't want to seem like I didn't know what I was doing, and I only brought one bid on with me, and it was a really hot summer's day and I was too embarrassed to ask the guys to stop so I could fill my water up, so I just kept a straight face, and then I said goodbye to them all in Berkhamsted, which is about a 20-minute ride from home. I started going up this climb and I never bonked so hard in my life. I got to the top of the hill in Berkhamsted and I couldn't go any further. I just sat in the ditch and I hadn't a phone on me or anything, and I just sat in this ditch. I was so gone, you know, had such a bad headache. I couldn't do anything, so I just sat there, and it was only by chance that someone passed who knew me, and I borrowed their phone, and they called my mum to come and pick me up.
And yet you're only sort of 15 minutes away.
Yeah.
Well, we've all made that mistake at some point or other. I mean, that kind of brings me on to the experience you've had this later part of the summer, riding the Vuelta for Aqua Blue. I mean, you're progressing. You rode for the Anpost team, the Irish team, for a couple of years, and then did a year with JLT. And then Aqua Blue came along, the first Irish pro continental team. And you basically find yourselves as a wild card selection for the Vuelta. So presumably right from the start of the year, you would have had your eyes on that, hoping that you'd get one of the nine places in the team. I mean, were you pretty confident that you'd be selected?
Like we heard, we were in the Vuelta kind of April time, I think it was. And straight away, I just like really, obviously really wanted to be in the team, you know, because I think it's everyone's dream to ride a Grand Tour when they're in cycling. And sometimes, you know, you can be a super good rider and the opportunity never comes around. So to have that opportunity there for me, I was going to do everything I could to take it, you know. I felt I had a good start to the season in the classics and in Australia. So I felt I kind of had a good chance getting the team. The only problem, I think, was that it was such a hilly course. It was always going to be that question of whether I could get over those mountains. And I had my confidence knocked a little bit in the Tour of Suisse. That was kind of not my best performance of the year, I'd say.
Because you finished outside the time limit on one of the mountainous days.
They're
all pretty mountainous days, aren't they, in the Tour of Switzerland. But tell me what happened on that particular day. I mean, were you just suffering?
I actually learned one of a huge lesson actually in Tour of Suisse, because I think physically I was in good shape, but I just spent so many pennies every day. You know, I wasn't saving energy like I did in the Vuelta. I was kind of so confident that I could just like go with all the attacks at the start, try and get in breakaways, and that I'd be fine. You know, I paid for that dearly, and you know, I was like doing that every day, just trying to get in the break, just going with stupid attacks. You know, like attacking myself and being an idiot. There was one stage it suddenly hit me when I'd been doing all that, following the moves, and then we went up, started the mountains, and I was like on this hour-long climb, and I was like, I'm in a lot of trouble here. And I like got through that day by the skin of my teeth, and then the next day I hadn't recovered. I'd just been going so hard each day for like the sort of rider I am, you know, who's a big guy. I can't be doing like stupid stuff at the start. And that day I got time cut, we were just there, it was just like the almost queen stage really, and made Gruppetto, but I was like shot, really shot, and that was my first kind of glimpse of like what the Gruppetto is. It's not a laughing group. You're riding like hard up the climbs and descending full gas, and in the valley you're like riding super hard, you know, really hard with top class guys. So went home from Swiss with my tail between my legs a bit, really, and realised that I've got a lot more work to do. But I learned a big lesson in how to save energy during a race and how not to do, you know, spending big chunks of energy and like following an attack that you could have not followed and been a bit smarter, just followed wheels, you know, and followed guys instead of attacking yourself and bounding up the line out like a stupid greyhound.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science and Sport. I think the biggest change in nutrition was the implementation of protein into all athletes' diets. And in the early days, when I first started, it was the domain of the sprinters, the power athletes, purely the longer distance guys, the endurance athletes. And you look at it now, and having it not just in sport, but across the board, everybody is aware of the importance of protein in staying lean, of maintaining lean muscle mass, repair, maintaining that positive nitrogen balance, which is so important. And it's also about the quality of your food and the quality of the ingredients of the food you eat. If it's supplementation, making sure it's trusted, a trusted company that know what they're doing, that you can get something that you're going to know there are no contaminants in there. You're putting your reputation on the line as a professional athlete. So I think in the last 20 years, protein, the quality of the produce that we're getting, and just the awareness, the general awareness has definitely gone up. People are more better educated. You know, it used to be these days of the odd person would anecdotally have a thing they would eat, something that, you know, you would think that's ridiculous. Why would you want to eat that particular thing? But because they won a few medals, then it almost said, well, if he can do it, I can do it that way too. And instead now, I think if you really want to get to the top, you have to eat the best possible food and have the best possible supplementation at the right time.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Science in Sport are still offering a 20% discount to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 20% off any Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, please use the code CPAUG20. That's CPAUG20. You know, arriving in Nîmes for the start and team time trial, obviously you must have been excited, I guess, but also a complete journey into the unknown for you and for some of the other guys too.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a journey into the unknown for all of us. Even the guys that have done Grand Tours before, the fact that we were like a team in our first year and we had this big challenge ahead of us for the team as a whole, it was a big new challenge for everyone. But I think we were all like really confident in ourselves. I think we were all pretty positive. The riders were a great bunch, you know. We all got on super well. We had a great crew of staff behind us, and we were all used to working with each other by that stage. We were all a proper unit then. So I think... personally, I was scared, you know. I was trying not to let it on to anyone. But I think we were up for it, you know. Like, we weren't thinking about the negatives.
You did a good team time trial as well on the first day. I mean, you know, it was certainly more than a respectable effort, wasn't it? And I mean, it must have been nice just to get the first one out of the way. And it was quite a wacky course, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really wacky. And I was pretty nervous actually when we reconned it on the, like, it was open roads, and it seemed even wackier, you know, when you're riding it with normal traffic. And I was thinking, I hope this, like, you don't want to crash, and you don't want to, like, be out in the prologue. It's not, you've come all this far. And like, before we started the prologue, actually, we were all just like, let's just kind of get through it safely, you know. It's like, not take any risks. I knew, like, as soon as we started, that would go out the window. We did hammer it a bit. but it was weird because we just, like, it went really well for us, that prologue, actually. We took all the corners way better than we'd done in training, and we'd had a few days to ride together as a team, so I think it kind of clicked into place a bit by the time we got on the start ramp. So it was good we did that training beforehand. And yeah, it was just surreal. You're like, the crowds are obviously huge, mad course, and you're in the Vuelta, and I just had to really just focus, you know, on the job in hand, just as any other race.
Who are you rooming with?
I was actually rooming with Larry Warbass, in the first half of the race, until unfortunately he crashed out. And Larry lives near me in Nice, so we get on really well. We train a lot together. I was so grateful to have him with me and room with me. He actually gave me so much advice for the whole Vuelta. I don't think I'd have got through it without the advice Larry had been giving me, you know.
Give us a couple of bits of the advice he gave.
I think, if Larry doesn't mind me saying, I think his character, he's like, he plans a lot, you know. He likes to just do everything he can to get himself in the best shape. So maybe I can be a bit more relaxed sometimes, you know. But Larry, like, when I room with him, I notice he just uses every bit of time he can to preparing himself for the next day and the day after that. And so,
well, just making sure everything's just ready, like his bag's, yeah, like, packed, and his shoes are ready. And because I imagine as the race goes on and you get more and more tired, you know, just taking the little bit of time to make sure those details are right, it must get really tempting just to lie on the bed and think, I've done my day, and then find that you're rushing in the morning, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Like, sometimes you're so tired, you just want to lie in your bed, you know, and flick for Instagram or something, or, you know, try and read a book if you've got the energy. But Larry would be over on the other side of the bed, like on his GPS file, looking at the next day's stage, you know, and looking at each road, looking at every corner, looking at the weather report, looking at where the brake might go, just everything, you know, gradients of all the climbs, and he'd write all the notes down. He'd be super, super prepared. So I'd be on my bed, you know, liking posts on Instagram about, like, cute dogs or something. And he made me feel quite bad, and I started getting into
Did you pick up a bit of that at the start? Because I suppose when it becomes a battle of survival, any little bit of information you can give yourself must come in handy. You know, if you know that there's going to be a climb that doesn't look like anything in the road book, but actually this might be quite hard. I'm assuming, think, well, if I can get forward into the first third of the bunch, I can give myself an easier ride on that climb. I guess as the days go by, you have to break each day down into making life as easy as you can for yourself.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Like, you're just looking at every little bit of energy you can save. So I actually started really looking at the course every day beforehand. If it was either a day where I had to survive the mountains or a day where I was trying to get in the breakaway. It's just the same, you know. If you're looking at a GPS file and you spot a bit of open road before a climb that no one else has seen, or like a climb that isn't marked and it's kind of gone unnoticed, you really need to know that. Or like a pinch in the road where the road gets small so you can like get ahead of it and get ahead of any fight for position, and just saving like a bit of energy of getting caught out in that situation. If you know all this information, then you're saving like a 5 minute effort, you know, full gas before an hour long climb or something like that. So it's like it's invaluable, and I think doing that really helped me.
Did you feel the first few days you were making some mistakes and learning some lessons? Because I remember seeing you in Andorra, and that had been a hard day, hadn't it? And obviously the race had, you know, in the grand scheme of things, had only just begun.
I think as it went on, I kind of got my system going. I got my recovery sorted. I found out when it was better to eat food and when to have my carbs a bit more, and I kind of got into the routine of it a bit more. I think the first week's the hardest, especially for me, because it was my first Grand Tour. When you just don't know what, you're completely in the unknown, you know. You're finding these things out. And yeah, I think the first week was the hardest. That Andorra stage was super tough. You got like a first big like long climb to begin with, and it's on. And you're like, you've got 3 weeks ahead, and you're like, flipping heck.
were there some pretty difficult moments in that first week?
Yeah, they were my most difficult moments of the whole race, in my opinion. A few grippy moments after that, obviously, but I think some of those days stand out as the hardest. Yeah, they were just, I think, as well, because people were commenting on it and saying, it's just the first week. Like, it hasn't started yet, it's not, the mountains aren't here, and it was like, oh. It was hard, you know, when you look back. Like, even if you look at my altitude meters, I had from week one, week two, week three, I actually had the greatest altitude gain in week one and the most time on the bike. So it was a hard first block. And yeah, some of the stages just were raced full gas, and you were really like in the line, just like really in the box.
Because I'm assuming going into the race, you would have been thinking, well, pick my days to try and get in some breaks. I mean, that's kind of what you do, isn't it? Or I'm going to, you know, try and work for the team, you know, where I can. But when it very quickly becomes a sort of battle of survival, I mean, mentally, I suppose you have to cut yourself a bit of slack, because towards the end of the first week, I think it was, you spoke to Richard one morning, I think it was, and I was back at home listening to the podcast, and I must admit, I thought, your morale is pretty low here. I could tell from the tone of your voice, and also from what you were saying, you were giving yourself a harder time probably than was necessary. But I did wonder at that point whether you'd still be in the race when I came back, because the physical battle's one thing, but if you start beating yourself up mentally as well, that's something else. I mean, talk to me a little bit about what was going through your mind in those few days and how you sort of pulled yourself around.
I think like there was a block of days, there's like four stages, I think, which were just day after day was like brutal. A few GC guys kind of gotten a few moves early. That one from Villarreal to Sagunt, I think a couple of GC guys slipped away, and Sky really kept a leash on it. It was only like a minute ahead. And that day was just like one of the most outrageous days I've had on a bike. I think it was like a combination of me feeling it a bit and just like being, you know, on a savage day in the Vuelta as well. You know, you're just in the line out and just like, you're literally just on the ropes, and it's just like, if you're in boxing, it was just, you're on the ropes and a guy's just punching you for the whole round after round.
So were you at the back of the peloton hanging on, trying to just get through the next 10 metres and the next 10 metres?
Oh yeah, because I'd actually knew that area a bit. I trained there one winter, so I knew some of the climbs, and on the road, but they just looked like little climbs, you know. And I remember starting one of the first ones and I recognised where I was. I was like, oh no, we're not going up this. And like the pace was so on that I was like at the back of it, and the line out was so hard that guys were already letting the wheel go at the bottom of this climb, and this was at the start of like a 200k stage. So I was like, oh, I'm in for a day here. And you're like sprinting out of corners, out of towns, up these climbs as if you were in the Belgium Kermesse. And that was just how the day went on. And I was like, I thought, oh, it's just a little fast bit and it will slow down. And it just never slowed down. I was like, if I finish that day, and I was like, if it's like this every day, you know, then maybe it's best I go and find another profession. That's the hard bit, you see, about it being in the unknown, being your first Grand Tour. You don't realise that there will be a few easier days, and it won't be like that every day.
Even when you get three or four in a row, it's hard to tell yourself that, I guess.
And
you're not in charge of when it lets up either, are you?
No, exactly. You had the noose around your neck, getting dragged around Spain. There was always a voice in the back of my head. No matter how much I whinged, there was a voice that was like, I wasn't going down easy, you know. I wasn't, just because it was that tough, I wasn't going to, like, I was still there, I was still hanging on, you know. I wasn't on my knees, you know. Well, I was on my knees, but I wasn't lying down. And I wasn't going out without a big fight.
And it was Adam Blythe, I think, who gave you a bit of a pep talk, is that right?
Yeah, I was...
Because he's a confident guy, isn't he? I mean, he must have recognised that your shoulders had dropped a little bit.
I'm the guy on the bus that's normally a bit of the joker. I'm not one to get down easily. I don't know if it was the tiredness, or I'm not sure, just the mental battle, you know. I was down that morning, even if I didn't really know why myself at the time. Adam just kind of told me, like, I was fine, I was doing well, and kept my chin up, and that actually meant so much to me. It was really, really heartwarming, actually, and just how we all stuck together got me through that day, actually, because I thought I was walking out the bus to get the pulp beaten out of me again. So that gave me the strength to, like, not think that day actually went fine for me. I was feeling good and didn't have any dramas.
And did things kind of lift a little bit from that point? I mean, I suppose... You never know when a bad moment might come along again. You might get another run of those days, I guess. But if you can survive that, you can think, well, I can maybe survive it again when it gets tough.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think surviving the day after the super hard day you've had, then you're like, well, actually, I wasn't too bad. You know, I was okay that day, and it didn't kill me. So your confidence starts to grow a bit. And I felt good in myself. Actually, I started coming around a bit more, and I got in the break on stage 9, and I felt good that day. We got caught on the climb, but it was nice to be out front, and I wasn't at the back for. And I was feeling good, and then from there, my confidence grew, and I got in the break again on the 11th stage, I think, and it was just got into the routine of it. And there was a lot of hard days in the second and third week too. They blur into one a bit, but I'd broken that little hump, you know, of how am I ever going to do this? And then as each day goes, you're like, yeah, I believe in myself, and I believe it a bit more, and you do a few things you didn't think you could do, and you get the confidence in yourself, I guess.
And of course, around about the middle of the race, the team bus got burnt out by an arsonist, basically. I mean, from what I understand, it was an act of vandalism. Somebody shoved a lit mattress under the bus, and it was discovered completely burnt out, wasn't it?
It was just a complete random act. It was the guy was apparently he was actually quite well held in society in the town. He had a proper job, you know. He wasn't just a complete lunatic, but I think he was a pyromaniac, and he set like 4 or 5 fires in the town, I think.
Wow.
Like separate fires, like not to do with cycling, because when I first heard it, I thought maybe it was a protest or something, and it was just completely random. Yeah, so we woke up to that morning, and it was just like every day of the world so far you'd have something that you weren't expecting, you know. There'd be some climb or some like stupid road, and then this morning it was like we didn't have our bus. So,
and of course, yeah, I mean, obviously, I think you had an emergency bus for one day, and then the Portuguese team very kindly offered to lend the team the bus to get you through to Madrid. But I mean, you can't really overstate how unsettling that must have been, because your bus is like your sanctuary, your second home, isn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't just get you from the hotel to the start and then from the finish back to the hotel again. It's kind of, you know, it's the place you're preparing for the race. It's your home from home. And so to have to do it in the first place. Did you have one day in some kind of rental bus before the Portuguese bus turned up?
No, we actually had a day, I think it was 2 days, we had in a school bus. And I didn't know this, but I think they must have this bus in most Grand Tours.
Right.
That it's like if someone's bus breaks, you get in this bus. And it reminded me a bit of Top Gear when they do the adventures and they have the like rubbish car following them behind and they don't want to end up in that car. It's like that, you know, because I remember seeing it once we got a proper bus. It was just in the start area, like right at the back. It's like, I'm here for you.
no mod cons in there at all.
No, it's just school bus, no seats and no toilet. That was it. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that morale must have taken a bit of a battering throughout the team those couple of days, I guess.
Yeah, like, I think we kind of, in our own typical Aqua Blue spirit, we saw the funny side of it, you know. And then we realised a few of us had lost our shoes and stuff in the other bus, and then the morale did dive a bit.
Oh, no.
But, we just got on with it, you know. It was had the banter with it. Niall, our press officer, kept the spirits high. He was having his moment of glory with the media outside, doing a big press release and fielding all the questions. I think he got a few numbers from girls in the media, so it was a good day for him.
Yeah, is that what the press officers do? I did wonder what they do. And then, of course, you know, you must have begun to feel that you would make it to Madrid once the second rest day and then a time trial. I mean, we can very glibly say, well, that's a kind of a day off. But, you know, you can get through 40-odd kilometres without, you know, putting yourself in a hole. Even if you have to go hard to make sure you're not in danger of, missing the time cut or what have you. But that final week still had Los Machucos and the Angliru.
Yeah.
Of course, the Los Machucos stage, you know, everyone was really excited to see what this crazy climb was like, and it was a crazy climb. But of course, for your team, it was the day Stefan Denifil won.
Yeah, and, incredible.
Suddenly, you know, whenever a wildcard team wins a stage in a Grand Tour, I mean, it's a big achievement, but that day, everything went perfectly, didn't it?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Like, it was always Stefan's plan to like target that third week, so he'd really saved himself the other weeks, like not going with any, trying to go in any breaks, just keep, you know, tranquilo as much as he could. We all kind of helped him get in the break, and it just worked out perfectly from the start. He was away, got a good gap, and he knew he had a chance. Like, I was thinking in my head he had a chance, but it was a hard stage. Like, looking back on it, I kind of, in the middle part, I personally forgot he was out there. I was just like suffering. We went up this big climb in the middle and it was so foggy and it all split on the descent, and you're like just kind of,
so you're almost in two different races, really.
You've
got your teammate up the road.
It was just weird.
That's almost irrelevant to you back in well,
yeah,
especially in the phase of the race where the gruppetto is going to start forming as well.
Yeah, like, you just hadn't the time to think about it, you know. It was just it was like a really long descent, I think, and in the fog, and you just couldn't see anything. And it went on for ages and ages. So it was like a surreal stage, you know. And then once you got to the bottom, you got out of the fog and you're in the gruppetto, and then you kind of heard the radio coming back in again. And then you're like, flipping heck, Stefan's like still away. And we're on the last Machuchos climb. And you could hear like the radio going, and Stefan's still away. And you're like, oh, no, he's not going to do it. And then you were like, you knew he was in the last couple Ks. But it's so hard when you, like, when you got a teammate in the break, and then you get the radio coming back, because you got out of contact pretty easily, out of range. So when you get the range again, because obviously the info is not for you on the radio at that point, you don't really know if he's with it on his own or with other people, or you're just trying to kind of figure it out. So I wasn't sure if he was racing for first or second or just a top 10, or because we were just getting time gaps. But then you heard like Contador's coming, like, you can do this. And then I was like, he's going for the win. And then like the last K, I knew he was going for the win, you know. And we were all like on different points of the climb, and I think we all just like went silent wherever we were, like, And then you just heard, like, Stefan's, you've done it. You've won, Stefan. Like, enjoy it. And it's just unbelievable feeling. Really, really unbelievable. Felt like you were winning with him. And we all just, like, you could hear everyone, like, yelling on different parts of the climb. Like,
so actually, as the news was coming through in their earpieces, they were still mini celebration.
Yeah,
even though you probably had another 20 minutes ahead of you.
Yeah, like I actually don't really remember the climb that much, to be honest, because I was so focused on trying to figure out what was going on. And then when he won, I was just like, I just wanted to get to the top. So it wasn't like a day of, normally you're at the last climb of the day, you're kind of slogging up it a bit. And that time I was just like, so over the moon for Stefan and for the team, that it just didn't really feel like a climb.
Now, something I didn't know about the team, Lassie Hansen told me at the top, was that there's a no alcohol rule at races. Is that, I mean, was that rule broken that evening or?
But yeah, we get if we win, we're allowed a little deviation from the rule. So
it's fair enough.
Yeah, right? We had a celebratory beer and a little bit of champagne. So it was good.
Completely fair enough. And obviously, you know, that justifies the team's place in the race, doesn't it? Having a victory like that.
I'm Simon Mottram. I'm the founder and chief executive of RAFA. I think the sport has everything. It is such an amazing combination of fitness and a social side, community side, culture, history, adventure, exploration, with a really strong aesthetic. It's accessible because we all ride bikes, or we all used to anyway. So I think it has everything. It has all those touch points. And then if you actually do it, all you have to do is get on a bike and try really hard for an hour, and you can get pretty close to what that satisfaction is.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Then you just had the small matter of the Angleroo to go. That was another day where I think you possibly got a little bit lucky with the conditions, because even though it was horrible, up at the top it had been absolutely awful early in the afternoon. It just cleared a little bit in time for the race to come up, although it was still very cold and very misty. But in terms of, you know, riding the Angleroo, I mean, you're 6'7", 6'8"?
6'8" and a half, nearly 6'9".
How many kilos?
88.
Yeah. Well, that's fewer than me, so I'm a good deal shorter. And I mean, in terms of, you know, tackling these climbs, this is not really your territory, is it, physically? You're not necessarily built for that kind of climbing effort.
No, it's not my forte. The steep climbs, I'm always going to be, the steep long ones are always going to be against me, just gravity pulling me back down to earth. But the Angleroo was actually I think the Angleroo was the toughest climb for the race, in my opinion anyway, because I think at that point, like, it was a tough day with the weather at the start, and I think by that point I was like, I've got this far, like, I was confident, you know. And then I was confident that we were on the bus. It's like hammering with rain, like really, really hammering, and you're like, oh, here we go. And I was like, oh, there's always something. And then we started, I remember we did the neutral, and it was still hammering down, and it was so windy that they were blowing all the barriers off where the real start was, so all the barriers were across the road, so we had to, like, slow down, and you were just seeing all these barriers across the road. You're like, oh, here we go.
Well, there's no suggestion the race was going to be shortened stopped, or, you know, I mean, it was real bad conditions at the start.
Yeah, I think by that point it was evident I was with a bunch of lunatics. that was my fate was sealed. But it was on, and it was on from the start. It was a tough start. Everyone going hard for the break, and pace was super, super fast. But I felt by that point I had confidence in what I could do on each climb, and I was confident enough to not, like, panic if I was in trouble. I knew if I could ride this pace and then descend okay, then I'd be fine. So that's just what I did. I was in the bunch until the last sequence of climbs, and then I just rode my own pace for the rest of that bit, and I was in the gruppetto at the bottom of the Angleroo without kind of being in too many dramas, you know, not like panicking and really going into the red. So it was, for me, it was anyway, that day was, it was okay. and you just had the Angaroo to go. So it was like, last climb, it will be grand. And flipping out, it was a hard climb. We all knew we were safe, like in the groupetta. There was loads of us there, and we had we weren't too far back, you know, so we had enough time to get up. But still, just getting up was hard. I started it, I had no idea. Like, I just knew the gradients in my head. Towards the top, like those last 6 or 7K, I think, and you're going around the hairpin and you look up and it just like goes off into the distance like a really steep pitch, just keeps on going. It's not a pitch, it's just the grade of the climb. It's a hard one, and it just keeps on going. And for a lot of it, I had 36, 34 or something like that, 34, 30 maybe.
Or not far off mountain bike gear almost.
Yeah, really, like super easy gear. And still I was out of the saddle grinding at some points. And like, that wasn't just me, that was everyone I was around. And it was, yeah, just a slog the whole way up. But yeah, when you knew once you got to the top, you'd conquered all the climbs.
Yeah, then just a flight to Madrid on the Sunday morning and a crit round,
yeah,
around the streets of Madrid.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you completed it. And I mean, did you feel like, you know, this has made me stronger, this experience has made me better, and do you feel like it will stand you in good stead for next season?
Yeah, definitely. I think mentally, more than anything, I think after now doing a grand tour, I think it's the mental side that is super tough. It's harder than other races. I think other races, this is my opinion, I think other races are more physical, like it's always a mental side, but I think it's more kind of physical, and then a grand tour is more kind of physical, mental, like you got to have the strength in your mind and be able to do it day in, day out. So like I've got so much respect for the GC guys, you know, who are like really on it every day and doing like incredible stuff every day. So I think for me, like getting through that has just given me a lot of confidence that I can get through these things and I can do it. And when my mind's telling me this is too hard for you, kind of like you can't do this, like this is stupid, you know, and then I've got the confidence, but I know actually I can do it. And I can get through this like super tough part of this race, and I can push forward, and I've done it, and I will do it again. I think that's what I've really taken from that race.
Your dad said that he went out for a few days. I think that must have been at the end of the second week.
Yeah,
with a cousin of yours or a cousin of his?
A cousin of mine.
A cousin,
yeah,
of yours. So you knew you had people coming out. I mean, that adds another different kind of pressure as well, doesn't it? You've got to still,
yeah,
be there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you've ruined your dad's holiday.
Yeah, exactly. So like, I had my family come out for the start, and then Stacey came for the rest day with her mum. So I was like, initially I was like, I can't like not be there for the rest of the day because Stacey will kill me. So like, I made sure I was there, and then my dad said he was coming to the Malaga stages, and I just knew he'd love it, the whole thing, you know. So I was, there was no way I wasn't getting through those stages, I was being there for him. And
he made it sound almost fun. He was riding in his island jersey.
Oh, he's having a great time.
High-fiving people on the road, riding the last climb each day. And,
yeah.
I mean, that's the other side of it, isn't it? People who go to watch the races, I mean, they don't get quite the same glimpse into what it requires to actually race in the event.
Yeah. But to be fair to him, he did a bit of riding. He said he went out, he did 20K one day, and he said it was too hot for him.
So that's just what you want to hear when you slog through 4.5 hours.
I know. Oh dear. No, he was loving it. And he's like, it doesn't hold back, my dad. So I knew, I saw him on every climb. He was jumping up and down. So that was so nice, you know. And he had his full Irish kit on. So I think he was causing a scene on all these mountains, you know, embarrassing me.
Supporting you, I think, yeah, is how he put it. After the Vuelta, of course, I guess your final race of the season, the World Championship road race, and just as you did in, it was Richmond, wasn't it, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
Where you got in the break for a good deal of time, you and a teammate both got in the break straight away, and I didn't see it on the TV, but I heard in the commentary that you were the one who kicked it off, is that right?
Yeah. I was the first one, the first idiot. But I felt good actually when I recovered from the Vuelta. I really took it easy that week. I just rested really hard, was just riding, trying to eat the best food I could, and doing everything to recover, and slept a lot. I was feeling really good on the bike, you know. I felt good, just tired off the bike. Like going around Carrefour supermarket was like the end of the world.
See, that's the glamour that people don't see when you get home and you've got to go and do the supermarket.
Right? I know. Yeah. But it was kind of nice just to do normal things again, actually. I felt good at Worlds, and we had a strong team with me, Sean, Ryan, Dan and Nico. So we had a good plan in place, and part of that plan was we decided I was going to go for the early break and try to kind of save as much energy as I could. And if Dan or Nico came up to me later in the race, then the aim was that I was fresh enough to be able to help them a bit. Yeah, I felt it was a great day for me. I really enjoyed it. Like, Norwegian fans were insane. It was unbelievable atmosphere.
And it was working pretty well, apart from the fact that the Belgians basically kept the gap pretty small. I mean, I think it was Yves Lampert was doing a lot of work on the front, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think Vermote as well, yeah.
Vermote, sorry, yeah, and kept the gap quite small, and then brought the break in probably earlier than, well, certainly earlier than you guys would have wanted. But also, it kind of sent the race into a bit of a kind of a strange period where nothing much was happening. But obviously, the pace was on, but nobody wanted to be up the road. It was quite an unusual one.
Yeah, I think they kind of, like, we got a decent hour gap to begin with, but I think they pegged us at like 5 or 6 minutes, maybe. They were like, every time we dipped below 5, I think they let us go out a bit more. So we were at 5 most of the race. And then I think after like 140, 150K, then we started really pushing on. And we kind of kept it there. And then suddenly, like in one lap, it was like, boom, they'd obviously just hammered it behind. And I heard from the guys later that it had been super fast that lap. So it was a shame, like, we didn't have a bit more of a buffer to be able to, like, leave it that. Because I think once it goes super fast like that, it lulls again a bit. So I was hoping to just be ahead of that. It was okay. I think we got a quarter, like, after 180K sort of thing. And I still had a bit of legs, like I was still there in the bunch for a bit, and tried to help the guys position, help Dan and Nico as much as I could. Then I was job done. And it was a good day out. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
So after your holiday, Nicaragua and Guatemala, what does next year hold in store? Do you know? I mean, I'm assuming you're staying with Aqua Blue next year.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what plans the team has for next year? Have you got any ideas what you'd like to do?
Not a massive idea just yet. We'll probably find out in the next month what the exact program is. You're still kind of waiting for race invites and things like that. It's not really my place to comment on what the team's program will be. But I'd like to, you know, keep on from where I left off this year. You know, take what I've learned this year as well, because it's been a varied year for me. I've done from the cobble classics, like, then I did the Liège, Flèche, those style of races, Swiss, Vuelta. So it's been a good variety there, and I've learned a lot in each race. So hopefully take that into next year, and hopefully a bit physically stronger. So you see what I can do as well. I'm super motivated to do a good winter and come out fighting again. So
Well, as long as you don't wander too far off the beaten track, you should be absolutely fine.
Yeah, hopefully.
Connor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to Connor Dunn talk about his experience at the Vuelta. If you like the Cycling Podcast enough to sign up as a friend of the podcast, please do. There's still time to listen to all of this year's episodes, and in fact all of our special episodes from the last 2 years, by signing up at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £10 for this year's episodes, and we've covered all sorts of things. There's in-depth interviews and features on the Giro and the Cobbled Classics and the Tour de France. A real mixed bag of bonus content too. Also, if you want to sign up for our newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com, and that will keep you in touch with when we release new episodes, when we've got live events happening, and other things that may be going on. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.